He shouldered the burden of command, doing everything he could to create conditions that would increase the number of prisoners who would survive unbroken, while fighting an internal war against his captors and their attempts to use prisoners for propaganda. At one point, he beat himself with a stool and cut himself with a razor, deliberately disfiguring himself so that he could not be put on videotape as an example of a well-treated prisoner. He exchanged secret intelligence information with his wife through their letters, knowing that discovery would mean torture and perhaps death. He instituted rules that would help people deal with torture. No one can resist torture indefinitely, so he created a stepwise system. After X minutes, you can say certain things that gave men milestones to survive toward. He instituted an elaborate internal communication system to reduce the sense of isolation that their captors tried to create, which used a 5x5 matrix of tap codes for alpha characters. Tap tap equals the letter A. Tap pause. Tap tap equals the letter B. Tap tap pause. Tap equals the letter F, and so forth, for 25 letters, C doubling in for K. At one point, during an imposed silence, the prisoners mopped and swept the central yard using the code, swish-washing out, "We love you," to Stockdale on the third anniversary of his being shot down. After his release, Stockdale became the first three-star officer in the history of the Navy to wear both aviator wings and the Congressional Medal of Honor. You can understand, then, my anticipation at the prospect of spending part of an afternoon with Admiral Stockdale. One of my students had written his paper on Stockdale, who happened to be a senior research fellow studying Stoic philosophers at the Hoover Institution right across the street from my office, and Stockdale invited the two of us for lunch. In preparation, I decided to read In Love and War. The book, Stockdale and His Wife, had written in alternating chapters, chronicling their experiences during those 8 years. As I moved through the book, I found myself getting depressed. It just seemed so bleak. The uncertainty of his fate, the brutality of his captors. And then it dawned on me. Here I am, sitting in my warm, comfortable Stanford office, looking out over the beautiful Stanford campus on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. I'm getting depressed reading this. And I know the end of the story. I know that he gets out. I know that he reunites with his family. I know he becomes a national hero. And I know he gets to spend the later years of his life studying philosophy on this same beautiful campus. If it feels depressing for me, how on earth did he deal with it when he was actually there and did not know the end of the story? "I never lost faith in the end of the story," he said. "I never doubted not only that I would get out, but also that I would prevail in the end and turn the experience into the defining event of my life, which in retrospect, I would not trade." I didn't say anything for many minutes, and we continued the slow walk toward the faculty club, Stockdale limping and arc-swinging his stiff leg that had never fully recovered from repeated torture. Finally, after about 100 meters of silence, I asked, "Admiral Stockdale, who didn't make it out, or as strong as you?" "Oh, that's easy," he said. "The Optimus." Confused. "The Optimus. I don't understand." "The Optimus. Oh, they were the ones who said, 'We're going to be out by Christmas.' And Christmas would come, and Christmas would go. Then they'd say, 'We're going to be out by Easter.' And Easter would come, and Easter would go. And then Thanksgiving. And then, It would be Christmas again. And they died of a broken heart. Another long pause. More walking. Then he turned to me and said, "This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be." To this day, I carry a mental image of Stockdale admonishing the optimists, "We're not getting out by Christmas. Deal with it." That conversation with Admiral Stockdale stayed with me, and in fact had a profound influence on my own development. Life is unfair. That's one of the first things you have to learn as you grow up. Life is unfair. Sometimes to our advantage, often to our disadvantage. We will all experience disappointments and crushing events somewhere along the way, setbacks for which there is no reason, no one to blame, no fault. It might be disease. It might be injury. It might be an accident. It might be losing a loved one. It might be getting swept away in a political shakeup. It might be getting shot down over Vietnam and thrown into a POW camp for 8 years. What separates people, Stockdale taught me, is not the presence or absence of difficulty, but how they deal with the inevitable difficulties of life. In wrestling with life's challenges, the Stockdale paradox, you must retain faith that you will prevail in the end. And you must also confront the most brutal facts of your current reality. This paradox has proved powerful for coming back from difficulties not weakened, but stronger. Not just for me, but for all those who've learned the lesson and tried to apply it. I never really considered my walk with Stockdale as part of my research into great companies, categorizing it more as a personal rather than a corporate lesson. But as we unraveled the research evidence, I kept coming back to it in my own mind, and finally, one day during a research team meeting, I just sort of blurted out the Stockdale story. There was silence around the table when I finished, and I thought, they must really think I'm out in left field. Then Dwayne Duffy, a quiet, thoughtful team member who had done the A&P versus Kroger analysis, said, "That's exactly what I've been struggling with. I've been trying to get my hands around the essential difference between A&P and Kroger. And that's it. Kroger was like Stockdale, and A&P was like the optimists who always thought they'd be out by Christmas." Then the other team members began to chime in, noting the same difference between their comparison sets. Wells Fargo versus Bank of America, both facing deregulation. Kimberly-Clark versus Scott Paper, both facing the terrible might of Procter & Gamble. Pitney Bowes versus Adressograph, both facing the loss of their monopolies. Nucor versus Bethlehem Steel, both facing imports, and so forth. They all demonstrated this paradoxical psychological pattern, and we dubbed it the Stockdale Paradox. The Stockdale Paradox is a signature of all those who create greatness, be it in leading their own lives or in leading others. Churchill had it during the Second World War. Admiral Stockdale, like Viktor Frankl before him, lived it in a prison camp. And while our good to great companies cannot claim to have experienced either the grandeur of saving the free world or the depth of personal experience of living in a prisoner of war camp, they all embraced the Stockdale paradox. It didn't matter how bleak the situation or how stultifying their mediocrity. They all maintained unwavering faith that they would not just survive, they would prevail. and yet at the same time, they became relentlessly disciplined at confronting the most brutal facts of their current reality. Like much of what we found in our research, the key elements of greatness are deceptively simple and straightforward. The good to great leaders were able to strip away so much noise and clutter and just focus on the few things that would have the greatest impact. They were able to do so in large part because they operated from both sides of the Stockdale paradox, never letting one side overshadow the other side. If you are able to adopt this dual pattern, you will dramatically increase the odds of making a series of good decisions and ultimately discovering a simple yet deeply insightful concept for making the really big choices. And once you have that simple unifying concept, you will be very close to making a sustained transformation to breakthrough results. It is to the creation of that concept that we will turn in the next chapter. Summary points to Chapter 4, Confront the Brutal Facts. All good to great companies began the process of finding a path to greatness by confronting the brutal facts of their current reality. When you start with an honest and diligent effort to determine the truth of your situation, the right decisions often become self-evident. It is impossible to make good decisions without infusing the entire process with an honest confrontation of the brutal facts. A primary task in taking a company from good to great is to create a culture wherein people have a tremendous opportunity to be heard, not just have their say, to be heard, and ultimately for the truth to be heard. Creating that climate, creating a culture where the truth is heard, involves four basic practices. 1. Lead with questions, not answers. 2. Engage in dialogue and debate, not coercion and manipulation. 3. Conduct autopsies without blame. 4. Build red flag mechanisms that turn information into information that cannot be ignored. The good to great companies faced just as much adversity as the comparison companies, but they responded to that adversity differently. They hit the realities of their situation head on. As a result, they emerged from adversity even stronger. A key psychology for leading from good to great is the Stockdale paradox. That paradox, in summary: retain absolute faith that you can and will prevail in the end regardless of the difficulties, and at the same time, confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. And as always, a few unexpected findings. Charisma, it turns out, can be as much a liability as an asset. Charisma and the strength of leadership personality can deter people from bringing you the brutal facts. Leadership does not begin just with vision. It begins with getting people to confront the brutal facts and to act on the implications. Spending time and energy trying to motivate people is a waste of effort. The real question is not, how do we motivate our people? Again, if you have the right people on the bus, they will be self-motivated. The key is not how to motivate people, but how to not demotivate people. One of the primary ways to demotivate people is to ignore the brutal facts of reality. Chapter 5, The Hedgehog Concept. Know thyself, Scribes of Delphi, via Plato. Are you a hedgehog or a fox? In his famous essay, The Hedgehog and the Fox, Isaiah Berlin divided the world into hedgehogs and foxes, based upon an ancient Greek parable. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. The fox is a cunning creature, able to devise a myriad of complex strategies for sneak attacks upon the hedgehog. Day in and day out, the fox circles around the hedgehog's den, waiting for the perfect moment to pounce. Fast, sleek, beautiful, fleet of foot, and crafty, the fox looks like the sure winner. The hedgehog, well, on the other hand, the hedgehog is a dowdier creature, looking like a genetic mix-up between a porcupine and a small armadillo. He waddles along, going about his simple day, searching for lunch and taking care of his home. The fox waits in cunning silence at the juncture in the trail. The hedgehog, minding his own business, wanders right into the path of the fox. "Aha! I've got you now," thinks the fox. He leaps out, bounding across the ground, lightning fast. The little hedgehog, sensing danger, looks up and thinks, "Here we go again. Will he ever learn?" Rolling up into a perfect little ball, the hedgehog becomes a sphere of sharp spikes, pointing outward in all directions. The fox, bounding towards his prey, sees the hedgehog defense and calls off the attack, retreating back to the forest. The fox begins to calculate a new line of attack. Each day, some version of this battle between the hedgehog and the fox takes place. And despite the greater cunning of the fox, the hedgehog always wins. Isaiah Berlin extrapolated from this little parable to divide people into two basic groups, two different types of thinkers, if you will. Foxes and hedgehogs. Foxes pursue many ends at the same time and see the world in all its complexity. They are scattered or diffused, moving on many levels, says Berlin, never integrating their thinking into one overall concept or unifying vision. Hedgehogs, on the other hand, they simplify a complex world into a single organizing idea, a basic principle or concept that unifies and guides everything. It doesn't matter how complex the world. A hedgehog reduces all challenges and dilemmas to simple, indeed almost simplistic, hedgehog ideas. For a hedgehog, anything that does not somehow relate to the hedgehog idea holds no relevance. Princeton professor Marvin Bressler pointed out the power of the hedgehog during one of our long conversations. "You want to know what separates those who make the biggest impact from all the others who are just as smart? They're hedgehogs." Freud and the unconscious, Darwin and natural selection, Marx and class struggle, Einstein and relativity, Adam Smith and the division of labor. They were all hedgehogs. They took a complex world and simplified it. "Those who leave the biggest footprints," said Bressler, "have thousands calling after them. Good idea, but you went too far." To be clear, hedgehogs are not stupid. Quite the contrary. They understand that the essence of profound insight is simplicity. What could be more simple than E equals MC squared? What could be simpler than the idea of the unconscious, organized into an id, ego, and superego? What could be more elegant than Adam Smith's pin factory and invisible hand? No, the hedgehogs aren't simpletons. They have a piercing insight that allows them to see through all the complexity and discern underlying patterns. Hedgehogs see what is essential and ignore the rest. What does all this talk of hedgehogs and foxes have to do with good to great? Everything. Those who built the good to great companies were, to one degree or another, hedgehogs. They used their hedgehog nature to drive toward what we came to call a hedgehog concept for their companies. Those who led the comparison companies, on the other hand, well, they tended to be foxes, never gaining the clarifying advantage of a single unifying hedgehog concept. Instead, they were scattered, diffused, inconsistent. Let's take the case of Walgreens versus Eckerd. Recall from Chapter 1 how Walgreens generated cumulative stock returns from the end of 1975 to 2000 that exceeded the market by over 15 times, handily beating such great companies as GE, Merck, Coca-Cola, and Intel. It was a remarkable performance for such an anonymous, some might even say boring, company. When interviewing Cork Walgreen, I kept asking him to go deeper to help us understand these extraordinary results. Finally, in exasperation, he said, "Look, it just wasn't that complicated. Once we understood the concept, we just moved straight ahead." What was the concept? Simply this. The best, most convenient drugstores with high profit per customer visit. That's it. That's the breakthrough strategy that Walgreens used to beat Intel, GE, Coca-Cola, Merck, and to beat the market by 15 times. The best, most convenient drugstores, steadily increasing profit per customer visit. In classic hedgehog style, Walgreens took this simple concept and implemented it with fanatical consistency. It embarked on a systematic program to replace all inconvenient locations with more convenient ones, preferably corner lots where customers could easily enter and exit from multiple directions. If a great corner location would open up just a block away from a profitable Walgreens store in a good location, the company would close the good store, even at a cost of $1 million to get out of the lease, to open a great new store on the corner. Walgreens pioneered drive-through pharmacies. They found that customers liked the idea and built hundreds of them. In urban areas, the company clustered its stores tightly together on the precept that no one should have to walk more than a few blocks to reach a Walgreens. In downtown San Francisco, for example, Walgreens clustered 9 stores within a 1-mile radius. 9 stores in a 1-mile radius. If you look closely, you will see Walgreens stores as densely packed in some cities as Starbucks coffee shops in Seattle. Walgreens then linked its convenience concept to a simple economic idea, profit per customer visit. Tight clustering, 9 stores per mile, leads to local economies of scale, which provides the cash for more clustering, which in turn draws more customers. By adding high-margin services like one-hour photo developing, Walgreens increases its profit per customer visit. More convenience leads to more customer visits, which when multiplied times increased profit per customer visit, throws cash back into the system to build even more convenient stores. It's a really simple model when you think about it. Store by store, block by block, city by city, region by region, convenient stores, more customers, times profit per customer visit, round and round that flywheel goes, Walgreens became more and more of a hedgehog with this incredibly simple idea. In a world overrun by management faddists, brilliant visionaries, ranting futurists, fear-mongers, motivational gurus, and all the rest, I don't know about you, but I find it refreshing to see a company that succeeded so brilliantly by taking one simple concept and just doing it with excellence and imagination. Becoming the best in the world at convenient drugstores, steadily increasing profit per customer visit. What could be more obvious and straightforward? Yet if it was so obvious and straightforward, why didn't Eckerd see it? Ah, now we get to the crux of the matter. Well, Walgreens stuck only to cities where it could implement the convenience clustering concept. We found no evidence of a similarly coherent concept for growth at Eckerd. Deal makers to the core, Eckerd's executives compulsively leapt at opportunities to acquire clumps of stores, 42 units here and 36 units there, in more of a hodgepodge fashion. Not hedgehog, hodgepodge, with no obvious unifying theme. While Walgreens executives understood that profitable growth would come by pruning away all that did not fit with the hedgehog concept, Eckerd executives, on the other hand, lurched after growth for growth's sake. In the early 1980s, just as Walgreens became religious about carrying out its convenient drugstore concept, Eckerd threw itself into the home video market with its purchase of American Home Video Corporation. Eckerd's CEO told Forbes magazine in 1981, "Some feel the purer we are, the better we'll be. But I want growth. And the home video industry is only emerging, unlike, say, drugstore chains." I mean, you can almost hear the sense of how boring, how simple, how unexciting drugstore chains, right? Eckerd's home video foray produced $31 million in spectacular, exciting losses before Eckerd sold it to Tandy, which crowed that it got the deal for $72 million below book value. In the precise year of Eckerd's American Home Video acquisition, Walgreens and Eckerd had virtually identical revenues. They both had $1.7 billion. 10 years later, though, Walgreens had grown to over twice the revenues of Eckerd, accumulating net profits $1 billion greater than Eckerd over the decade. 20 years later, Walgreens was going strong as one of the most sustained transformations in our study. Meanwhile, Eckerd ceased to exist as an independent company. The three circles. The notion of a hedgehog concept originated in our research team meetings when we were trying to make sense of Walgreens' spectacular returns. "Aren't we just talking about strategy?" I asked. "Convenient drugstores, profit per customer visit, isn't that just basic strategy? What's so interesting about that?" "But Eckerd also had strategy," said Ginny Cooper, who analyzed the contrast between the two companies. "We can't say that it's just about having strategy. They both had a strategy, and they both had a strategy that was clear and well articulated." Ginny was correct in her observation. Strategy per se, or at least having a strategy, having a clear strategy, having thought about strategy, did not distinguish the good to great companies from the comparison companies. Both sets of companies had strategic plans. And there's no evidence that the good to great companies invested more time and energy in strategy development and long-range planning. Both sets of companies did it. "Okay, so are we just talking about good strategy versus bad strategy?" I pushed back. The team sat there for a minute, thinking. Then Lee Wilbanks observed, "But what I find so striking is their incredible simplicity. I mean, look at Kroger with the superstore concept, or Kimberly-Clark with the move to paper-based consumer products, or Walgreens with convenient drugstores. These were simple, simple, simple ideas." The research team members all jumped into the fray, bantering about the companies they were studying. It soon became abundantly clear that all the good to great companies attained a very simple concept that they used as a frame of reference for all their decisions, and this understanding coincided with breakthrough results. Meanwhile, the comparison companies like Eckerd got all trapped up by their snazzy strategies for growth. "Okay," I pushed back, "but is simplicity enough? Just because it's simple doesn't mean it's right. The world is filled with failed companies that had simple ideas that were wrong ideas." We decided to undertake a systematic look at the concepts that guided the good to great companies in contrast to the comparison companies. After a few months of sifting and sorting, considering possibilities and tossing them out, we finally came to see that the hedgehog concept in each good to great company wasn't just any random simple idea, wasn't a simple idea just for the sake of having a simple idea. The essential strategic difference between the good to great and comparison companies lay in two fundamental distinctions. First, the good to great companies founded their strategies on deep understanding along three key dimensions, what we came to call the three circles. I'll come to those in a moment. Second, the good to great companies translated that understanding into a simple crystalline concept that guided all their efforts. Hence the term, a hedgehog concept. More precisely, a hedgehog concept is a simple crystalline concept that flows from deep understanding about the intersection of the following three circles. Circle number one. What you can be the best in the world at. And equally important, what you cannot be the best in the world at. This discerning standard goes far beyond core competence. Just because you possess a core competence doesn't necessarily mean you can be the best in the world at it. Conversely, what you can be the best at might not even be something in which you are currently engaged. Number two. What drives your economic engine? All the good to great companies attained piercing insight into how to most effectively generate sustained and robust cash flow and profitability. In particular, they discovered a single denominator, an economic ratio, profit per X, that had the greatest impact on their economics. In segments of the social sector, this might be cash flow per X. Three, what you are deeply passionate about. The good to great companies focused on those activities that ignited their passions. The idea here is not to stimulate passion, but to discover what makes you passionate. Okay, I've thrown a lot at you. Let's stand back and simplify this idea a bit, and I want to give you an analogy to help you get the three circles. As I just described them, in the business setting, it's three circles of the hedgehog. What you can be the best in the world at, what best drives your economic engine, and what you're deeply passionate about. And you try to find the intersection of those three. Now, to grasp this idea, consider a personal analogy. Suppose you were able to construct a work life that meets the following three tests. First, you're doing work for which you have a genetic or God-given talent. And perhaps you could even become one of the best in the world at applying that talent. That when you do it, there's just this sense of, I feel I was born to be doing this. I feel that I was constructed to do this. Somehow those tumblers, genetic tumblers, fell into place and I was put here to do this. You're like a fish in water. Second, you're actually well paid for what you do. And you find yourself thinking sometimes, my goodness, I get paid to do this? Am I dreaming? How did I win the lottery? And third, you're doing work you're passionate about and you absolutely love to do, enjoying the actual process for its own sake. And you find yourself thinking, I look forward to getting up and throwing myself into the work every single day, and I really believe in what I'm doing. Now imagine you had all three of those. You're passionate about it. You love to do it. You're genetically encoded for it. And your economics work, you can make a living at it. You have a hedgehog concept. If you could drive toward the intersection of these three circles and translate that intersection into a simple crystalline concept that guided your life choices, then you'd have a hedgehog concept for yourself. To have a fully developed hedgehog concept, you need all three circles. If you make a lot of money doing things at which you could never be the best or of which you don't have genetic talent, you'll only build a successful company or a successful life, but not necessarily a great one. If you become the best at something, you'll never remain on top if you don't have intrinsic passion for what you are doing. Finally, you can be passionate all you want, but if you can't be the best at it, or it doesn't make economic sense, then you might have a lot of fun, but you won't produce great results. You need all three circles. Passion, best at, economics. At a personal level, passion, genetic encoding, making a living. Understanding what you can and what you cannot be the best at. They stick with what they understand and they let their abilities, not their egos, determine what they attempt. So wrote Warren Buffett about his $290 million investment in Wells Fargo, despite his serious reservations about the banking industry. Prior to clarifying its hedgehog concept, Wells Fargo had tried to be a global bank, operating like a mini Citicorp and a mediocre one at that. Then, at first under Dick Cooley and then under Carl Reichardt, Wells Fargo executives began to ask themselves a piercing set of questions. What can we potentially do better than any other company? And equally important, what can we not do better than any other company? And if we can't be the best at it, then why on earth are we doing it at all? Setting aside their egos, the Wells Fargo team pulled the plug on the vast majority of its international operations, accepting the truth, the brutal fact, that it could not be better than Citicorp in global banking. Wells then turned its attention to what it could be the best in the world at, running a bank like a business with a focus on the Western United States. That's it. Yep, that's the essence of the hedgehog concept that turned Wells Fargo from a mediocre Citicorp wannabe to one of the best performing banks in the world. Carl Reichert, CEO of Wells Fargo at the time, stands as a consummate hedgehog. While his counterparts at Bank of America went into a reaction revolution panic mode in response to deregulation, hiring change gurus who use sophisticated models and time-consuming encounter groups, Reichert, well, the hedgehog himself, stripped everything down to its essential simplicity. "It's not space science stuff," he told us in our interview. "What we did was so simple, and we kept it simple. It was so straightforward and obvious that it sounds almost ridiculous to talk about. The average businessman coming in from a highly competitive industry with no regulations would have jumped on this like a goose on a June bug." Reichert kept people relentlessly focused on the simple hedgehog idea, continually reminding them that there's more money to be made in Modesto than Tokyo. Those who worked with Reichert marveled at his genius for simplicity. And here is a classic hedgehog quote. "If Carl were an Olympic diver," said one of his colleagues, "he would not do a five-flip twisting sort of thing. He would do the best swan dive in the world and do it perfectly over and over again." Hedgehog, not fox. The Wells Fargo focus on its hedgehog concept was so intense that it became, in its executives' own words, a mantra. Throughout our interviews, Wells Fargo people told us it wasn't that complicated. We just took a hard-nosed look at what we were doing and decided to focus entirely on those few things we knew we could do better than anyone else, not getting distracted into arenas that would feed our egos and at which we could not possibly be the best. This brings me to one of the most crucial points of this chapter, indeed perhaps of the whole book. A hedgehog concept is not a goal. It is not a goal to be the best, a strategy to be the best, an intention to be the best, a plan to be the best. No, the key word is understanding. It is an insightful, piercing understanding of what you can be the best at. The distinction is crucial. Every company would like to be the best at something, but few actually understand with piercing insight and egoless clarity what they actually have the potential to be the best at. And just as important, what they can't be the best at. And it's this distinction that stands as one of the primary contrasts between the good to great companies and the mediocre comparison companies. Let's look at the contrast between Abbott Laboratories and Upjohn. In 1964, the two companies were almost identical in terms of revenues, profits, and product lines. Both companies had the bulk of their business in pharmaceuticals, principally antibiotics. Both companies had family management. Both companies lagged behind the rest of the pharmaceutical industry. But then, in 1974, Abbott had a breakthrough in performance, producing cumulative returns 4 times the market and 5.5 times Upjohn over the next 15 years. One crucial difference between the two companies is that Abbott developed a hedgehog concept based on what it could be best at, and Upjohn did not. Abbott began by confronting the brutal facts. By 1964, Abbott had lost the opportunity to become the best pharmaceutical company. And they knew it. Abbott had drowsily lumbered along in the 1940s and 50s, living off its cash cow products. In the meantime, companies like Merck had built research engines that rivaled Harvard and Berkeley. By 1964, George Kane and his Abbott team realized that Merck and others had such a huge research lead that trying to be the best pharmaceutical company would be like a high school football team trying to take on the Dallas Cowboys. It just wasn't going to happen. Even though Abbott's entire history lay in pharmaceuticals, and the vast majority of its revenues and profits came from pharmaceuticals, becoming the best pharmaceutical company was no longer a viable option. Brutal fact. So, guided by a level 5 leader, and tapping into the faith side of the Stockdale paradox, there must be a way for us to prevail, and we will find it. The Abbott team sought to understand what it could be the best at. Around 1967, a key insight emerged. Yes, we've lost the chance to be the best pharmaceutical company, but we have an opportunity to excel at creating products that contribute to cost-effective healthcare. Abbott had experimented with hospital nutritional products, designed to help patients quickly regain their strength after surgery, and also in diagnostic devices. One of the primary ways to reduce healthcare costs is to get the diagnosis right up front. Abbott eventually became the number one company in both of these arenas, which moved it far down the path of becoming the best company in the world at creating products that make healthcare more cost effective. What about Upjohn? Upjohn never confronted the brutal fact. Upjohn also lost the chance to be the best at pharmaceuticals. Continued to live with the delusion that it could beat Merck. Later, when it fell even further behind the pharmaceutical leaders, it diversified into arenas where it definitely could not be the best in the world, such as plastics and chemicals. As Upjohn fell even further behind, it returned to a focus on ethical drugs, yet never confronted the fact that it was just too small to win in the big stakes pharmaceutical game, despite consistently spending nearly twice the percentage of sales on research and development as Abbott. Upjohn saw its profits dwindle to less than half those of Abbott before being acquired in 1995. The Abbott versus Upjohn case highlights the difference between a core business and a hedgehog concept. Just because something is your core business, just because you've been doing it for years, perhaps even decades, well, that doesn't mean you can be the best in the world at it. And if you can't be the best in the world at your core business, even if your core business is 100% of your revenues, if you can't be the best in the world at it, then your core business cannot form the basis of your hedgehog concept. Clearly, then, a hedgehog concept is not the same as a core competence. You can have a competence at something, but not necessarily have the potential to be the best in the world at it. Let me use a personal analogy. Consider the young person who gets straight A's in high school, in calculus and scores high on the math test part of the SAT, to demonstrating a clear core competence at mathematics. Well, does that mean the person should become a mathematician? Well, not necessarily. See, I was one of those people that did really well in math in high school, and I went off to college thinking that I was going to become a mathematician. And then I went into the classes and the math classes and met those who, unlike me, are genetically encoded for math. They were different. And there was no way that I could ever really seriously entertain mathematics once I understood that difference. Many people have been pulled or fallen into careers where they can never attain complete mastery and fulfillment. Suffering from the curse of competence but lacking a clear hedgehog concept, they rarely become great at what they do. The hedgehog concept requires a severe standard of excellence. It's not just about building on strength and competence, but about understanding what your organization truly has the potential to be the very best at and sticking to it. Like Upjohn, the comparison company stuck to businesses at which they were good, but could never be the best. Or worse, launched off in pursuit of easy growth and profits in arenas where they had no hope of being the best. Sure, they made money, but they never became great. To go from good to great requires transcending the curse of competence. It requires the discipline to say, hey, just because we're good at it, just because we're making money and generating growth, doesn't mean necessarily we can become the best at it. The good to great companies understood that doing what you are good at, that will only make you good. Focusing solely on what you can potentially do better than any other organization, that's the only path to greatness. Every good to great company eventually gained a deep understanding of this principle and pinned their futures on allocating resources to those few areas where they could potentially be the best. The comparison companies rarely attained this understanding. On page 101 of the hardcover edition of Good to Great, I've included a table of the good to great companies and the best in the world circle of the hedgehog concept. I've laid it out more in detail there, but I'm going to go through the main pieces of that table here for you. The key point here is that this list does not show what the companies were already best in the world at when they began their transitions. In fact, most of the companies we studied weren't the best at anything when they began their transitions. Rather, it shows what they came to understand. Again, that key word, understanding. They came to understand what they could become the best in the world at. Abbott Laboratories came to understand that it could become the best at creating a product portfolio that lowers the cost of healthcare. Circuit City came to understand that it could become the best at implementing what it called a 4S model, service, selection, savings, and satisfaction, applied to big-ticket consumer sales. Fannie Mae came to understand that it could become the best capital markets player in anything that pertains to mortgages. Gillette came to understand that it could become the best at building premier global brands of daily necessities that require sophisticated manufacturing technology. Just think of all those billions of razor blades. Kimberly-Clark came to understand that it could become the best in the world at paper-based consumer products. Kroger came to understand that it could become the best at innovative super combination stores. Nucor came to understand that it could become the best at harnessing culture and technology to produce low-cost steel. Philip Morris came to understand it could become the best in the world at building brand loyalty in cigarettes and later other consumables. Pitney Bowes came to understand that it could become the best in the world at messaging that requires sophisticated back-office equipment. Key part to this in Pitney's case, I just want to briefly mention, is it had a really key insight that it was not a postage company, but it could have a broader definition, which was around messaging, and that it had particular strength in these back rooms and sophisticated machines. Walgreens, well, we talked about them earlier, could become the best in the world at convenient drugstores. Wells Fargo understood that it could become the best at running a bank like a business, with a focus on the Western United States. Circle number 2, insight into your economic engine. What is your denominator? The good to great companies frequently produced spectacular returns in very unspectacular industries. The banking industry ranked in the bottom quartile of industries in total returns during the same period that Wells Fargo beat the market by 4 times. Even more impressive, both Pitney Bowes and Nucor were in the bottom 5% industries, yet both these companies beat the market by well over 5 times. Only one of the good to great companies had the benefit of being in a great industry, defined as a top 10% industry. 5 were in good industries, and 5 were in bad to terrible industries. Our study clearly shows that a company does not need to be in a great industry to become a great company. Each good to great company built a fabulous economic engine, regardless of the industry. They were able to do this because they attained profound insights into their economics. This is not a book on microeconomics. Each company and each industry had its own economic realities, and I'm not going to belabor them all here. The central point is that each good to great company attained deep understanding of the key drivers in its economic engine and built its system in accordance with this understanding. That said, we did notice one particularly provocative form of economic insight that every good to great company attained, the notion of a single economic denominator. Consider the following question. If you could pick one and only one ratio, profit per X, to systematically increase over time. Now, if you're in the social sector, you might think in terms of cash flow per X. What X would have the greatest and most sustainable impact on your economic engine? We learned that this single question leads to profound insight into the inner workings of an organization's economics. Recall how Walgreens switched its focus from profit per store to profit per customer visit. Convenient locations are expensive, but by increasing profit per customer visit, Walgreens was able to increase convenience, remember, 9 stores in a mile, and simultaneously increase profitability across its entire system. The standard metric of profit per store would have run contrary to the convenience concept. The quickest way to increase profit per store is to decrease the number of stores and put them in less expensive locations. This would have destroyed the convenience concept. Or consider Wells Fargo. When the Wells Fargo team confronted the brutal fact that deregulation would transform banking into a commodity, they realized that standard banker metrics like profit per loan and profit per deposit would no longer be the key drivers. Instead, they grasped a new denominator, profit per employee. Following this logic, Wells Fargo became one of the first banks to change its distribution system to rely primarily on stripped down branches and ATMs. The denominator can be quite subtle, sometimes even unobvious. The key is to use the question of the denominator to gain understanding and insight into your economic model. The point is not to have a denominator for the sake of having a denominator. The point is to use the pursuit, the intellectual quest for a denominator to help you understand deeper, more core levels to what really drives your economic system. For example, Fannie Mae grasped the subtle denominator of profit per mortgage risk level, not profit per mortgage, which would be the obvious choice. It's a brilliant insight. The real driver in Fannie Mae's economics during that transition era when David Maxwell changed the company was the ability to understand risk of default in a package of mortgages better than anyone else. Then it made money selling insurance and managing the spread on that risk. Simple, insightful, unobvious, and right. Nucor made its mark in the ferociously price-competitive steel industry with the denominator profit per ton of finished steel. At first glance, you might think that per employee or per fixed cost might be the proper denominator. But the Nucor people understood that the driving force in its economic engine was a combination of a strong work ethic culture. Remember all those farmers and the guy getting chased out of the plant with the angle iron and we're going to get up at 4 a.m. and make steel? Okay, it's a combination of a strong work ethic culture and the application of advanced manufacturing technology, and it's putting those two together. Profit per employee or per fixed cost would not capture this duality as well as profit per ton of finished steel. Do you need to have a single denominator? No. But pushing for a single denominator tends to produce better insight than letting yourself off the hook with 3 or 4 denominators. The denominator question serves as a mechanism to force deeper understanding of the key drivers in your economic engine. As the denominator question emerged from the research, we tested the question on a number of executive teams. We found that the question always stimulated intense dialogue and debate. Furthermore, even in cases where the team failed, or in some cases refused, to identify a single denominator, the challenge of the question drove them to deeper insight. And that is, after all, the point. To have a denominator not for the sake of just having a denominator, but for the sake of gaining insight, deep, penetrating, piercing insight that ultimately leads to more robust and sustainable economics. On page 106 of the hardcover edition of Good to Great, we included a table which shows the economic denominator insight attained by each of the Good to Great companies during the pivotal transition years. What you'll find if you go look at that table is that there is no one single denominator that cuts across all the companies. Some, such as Abbott, had profit per employee. Circuit City had profit per geographic region. Fannie Mae had profit per mortgage risk level. There's no predetermined right answer. And why is this? The key reason why is because you have to discover for your own situation, for yourself, what is the one right denominator that will best drive your peculiar, specific economic engine. I can't give you that answer. No consultant can give you that answer. No one in the outside world can give you that answer. You have to come to that answer by using your own team, your own dialogue, your own debate, your own analysis, your own insight. Every Good to Great company discovered a key economic denominator, while the comparison companies usually did not. In fact, we found only one comparison case that attained a profound insight into its economics at the same level as the Good to Great companies. This is Hasbro. Hasbro built its upswing on the insight that a portfolio of classic toys and games, such as G.I. Joe and Monopoly, produces more sustainable cash flow than these huge one-time hits. In fact, Hasbro is the one comparison company that understood all three circles of its hedgehog concept. It became the best in the world at acquiring and renewing tried and true toys, reintroducing and recycling them at just the right time to increase profit per classic brand. Now notice that. That's a beautiful economic denominator. Profit per classic brand over the lifespan of one of those classic brands. Again, there's no one-size-fits-all denominator. It's what denominator is right for you. And its people had great passion for the business. Systematically building from all three circles, Hasbro became the best-performing comparison company in our study, lending further credence to the power of having a hedgehog concept. Now, you might be wondering, well, with all that great performance and having a clear hedgehog concept, why did Hasbro end up as a comparison company? Hasbro became a comparison company, an unsustained transition comparison company, in part because it lost its discipline to stay within its three circles after the unexpected death of CEO Steven Hassenfeld. The Hasbro case reinforces a vital lesson of this book. If you successfully apply these ideas, but then stop doing them, lose your disciplines, you will slide backward, from great to good or worse. The only way to remain great is to keep applying the fundamental principles that made you great. Understanding your passion. When interviewing the Philip Morris executives, we encountered an intensity, a passion that surprised us. Recall from Chapter 3 how George Weissman described working at the company as the great love affair of his life, second only to his marriage. Even with a most sinful collection of consumer products, Marlboro cigarettes, Miller beer, 67% fat-filled Velveeta cheese, Maxwell House coffee for caffeine addicts, Toblerone for chocoholics, and so forth, we found tremendous passion for the business. Most of the top executives at Philip Morris were passionate consumers of their own products. In 1979, Ross Millhiser, then vice chairman and a dedicated smoker, said, "I love cigarettes. It's one of the things that makes life really worth living." The Philip Morris people clearly loved their company and had passion for what they were doing. It's as if they viewed themselves as the lone, fiercely independent cowboy depicted in the Marlboro billboards. "We have a right to smoke. We will protect that right. You cannot take away that right. Do not tread on me." A board member told me during my research for a previous project, "I really love being on the board of Philip Morris. It's like being part of something really special." She said this as she proudly puffed away. Now you might think, but that's just the defensiveness of the tobacco industry. Of course, they'd feel that way. Otherwise, how could these people sleep at night? But let's look at the comparison company, which was also